Today we conclude our study in the book of James, and interestingly enough, the focus of that attention is on something that is very similar to what we've been talking about up to this point. Rather than reaching out to those who are lost, this is more of a focus and emphasis on reaching out to those who've become wayward, those who are distant from God, those who have wandered from the truth. And so the primary focus of James is to the church. He wrote to the church. He even addresses this to the brothers. But he reminds us that as the church body, one of our primary responsibilities is the ministry of restoration. We all go through ups and downs. We all go through challenges and issues of life that can at times interfere with one's faith or can misdirect and lead us down the wrong path. And so how do we get back, and where do we turn to, and what is the attitude of the church toward those who have lost their way, and how do we reclaim them or help them to be reclaimed for the gospel and the kingdom? And so James addresses this as his final words of instruction to the churches that he is writing to, and certainly it remains very relevant today. If we have learned nothing, we have learned that in the past year, during a time when we were encouraged to stay away from one another, and during a time when we were even shut down and people were not allowed together in groups and things of that sort, we have learned something from all of that. During that time, a lot of people found that they liked having church on a streaming service. I remember many conversations when we started coming back together and encouraging people to return to in-person meeting at church. There were several who asked if we had installed recliners because that's what they'd gotten used to listening to me in. I don't need you to be in any sort of position or degree of comfort that could promote more sleep than what I'm already doing. And so I understand that, but there were a lot of people that were actively involved in church, or at least moderately so, that during this time found themselves not only moved away from it, but now focused on other things, and a lot of those folks haven't come back, not to this church or to any church. They have lost their way. And as a result of that, they are now isolated from the church. And what comes in after so much time has passed is shame and guilt. And shame and guilt is something that our natural response to is to hide or deny. And so this only further deepens the distance and the gap between people who have lost their way. The only way to close that gap is not just by praying for them, but also going to them. And so how do we reach out to them? How do we encourage people? And how do we become a part of the ministry of restoration? That's our focus today. Think about this. James has written a general letter of encouragement to believers everywhere to inspire continued devotion to the gospel in a way that transforms the life of the believer in every experience and at every level. Believers can grow stronger through the trials of life. He teaches us that we can learn to practice faith so that our works support and reveal the beliefs that we claim. We can reject favoritism and worldly values. We can control the speech to avoid lies and a destructive influence on others. We can seek wisdom from God, pursue friendship with God rather than the world, learn to trust God, seeking His will in everything. We can grow so that we become patient, prayerful, and persistent in our care for others. And now finally, he encourages us to reach out to those in need of spiritual restoration. All of the directives that are given by James are uniquely able to strengthen the believer and lead to spiritual maturity. The result will be stronger believers, but also stronger churches that remain steadfast in genuine faith. And that is the theme of the study that we began with. James now concludes his instructions on how we can help others through the ministry of restoration. I can't think of a better time in the history of the church for us to engage not only in outreach to the lost, but also reaching out to those who've lost their way. Chapter 5, verse 19 says, "My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." The very first part of verse 1, he says that, "My brothers, if anyone wanders from the truth." There needs to be within the congregation of the church, there needs to be the care for the wayward. The word wandering and wayward all kind of come from the same thing. And he'll explain further, and I'll go along with that in a moment to give more definition to that. But essentially, he's talking about someone who's on a journey, and there is a very specific path, in fact, only one path, that leads where you are to go. And if you deviate from that, you find yourself either on a dead end or you find yourself on a destructive path that is not going to take you to the proper destination. Someone asked me the other day, "How do you go to Columbia?" And I said, I take 44 to 68 and up to 63 at St. James, and then I get on 63 and I go north through Jeff City. He said, "Well, why do you go that way? That's not the shortest way." I said, "It's the way I like. I'm comfortable with the road. I like the way the traffic moves along, and I get the highest degree of four-lane hardtop that I can possibly get." "Well, it's quicker to go 50. I go 50 occasionally just for variety, but I don't like 185, and I don't like H. In fact, I like H even less, and so I don't go that way. Well, you can go 185 to 19. I can. And I have. I do that also for variety. Once a year I'll do that just in order to throw in something else that's kind of unique. And it allows me to see scenery that I don't otherwise. If you look at Google Maps, it'll tell you to go through Warrenton. That makes no sense to me whatsoever because it just seems counterintuitive. And it's like I'm going east in order to go west. And I know that when I look at the map, I'm going north. But it doesn't feel that way. And you all know what an emotional person I am. And so I have to feel good about my choice. Now, I've gone all of these different ways. Marty Tiefenbrunn had a way that I never could figure out, and I don't know how to do it. Maybe you can tell me, Donna. But he would go up, and he just swore up and down that this was the best way to get to Columbia, and he did it a million times. And it took me through the country, and I was lost most of the time. I saw, like, it felt like I was going to Owensville or something. I don't know where I was. It was a road that I would be more excited about driving my motorcycle on than a car. But nonetheless, all of them are within about 5 to 10 minutes difference in time. I mean, you just pick whichever one you want, and we can race, and we're going to get there pretty close to the same amount of time. It depends on whether you've got a tractor in front of you or whether or not you've got somebody who's out for just a leisurely drive along the way enjoying the scenery, or whether or not you're on the road with somebody who's trying to get to Jefferson City to a meeting or something like that, and things move along pretty quickly. I'm just telling you that there are a lot of different options that you can choose from. Pick the one you like. You can do it emotionally the way I do it, or you can do it some other way, the way you do it. Here's my point. All of that may be true if you're making a journey to somewhere in this country. You can choose different paths to get there. But when it comes to the purpose of God and the reality of serving Him for His own glory, there's only one path, and that leads ultimately and inevitably to Jesus. That's the way it is. And it remains that way even after your salvation experience, so that through Christ and the work of His Spirit within and the application of His truth in our lives, through Christ and the truth of the gospel, we are being developed, sanctified, made into those set apart people for a purpose and glory that is not our own but belongs to God. When we serve self, we generally find ourselves seeking sin. But when we serve Jesus, we walk in the truth. That being said, care for the wayward should be an active part of what God has called us to, understanding there is only one direction. He says, my brothers. James addresses the fellow believers, referring to them as brothers and sisters, reminding us that we are related through Christ, that we are brought into a relationship by which we are connected to one another forevermore, and as a result of that, we belong to the same family. James wants us to understand not just the privilege that is represented in God's grace, but also the responsibility. Not just the reality, but also the accountability. The focus here is on mutual care in the body of Christ for the spiritual welfare of others. We are responsible for one another's spiritual well-being. The church has a responsibility to pay attention to those around them. Discipleship is more than personal. It must also be corporate. He says, be careful. Think about this. What happens when someone wanders? The word wanders that he speaks of here in verse 19, if any among you wanders from the truth, wanders is a word that doesn't mean that someone inadvertently took the wrong turn. It is a willful act in which we choose to go in a direction that is not consistent with God's leadership. When we wander from the truth, we do so as a result of our own decision. He's not removing any of the responsibility, but he is saying that even in the midst of that, there is an opportunity to turn someone back. All of us should be able to relate to this word because all of us on a regular basis, as James himself even says, that we all stumble in every way. All of us finds ourselves making those bad choices or doing things that we ultimately or immediately regret. But notice he says, wanders from the truth. Truth here speaks to more than just doctrinal understanding or belief or intellectual understanding or belief. He's not talking about the body of doctrine by which we understand the teachings of Scripture. He's talking about less of the intellectual and more of the moral. So as James has been focused on faith that works, so also now he is focused on truth that transforms. He's talking about moral truth, the application of truth, the truth of God's word, the doctrine of belief, all of those things, the application that changes the way we think and the way we behave, the way we speak and the way we address one another. And so when we wander from the truth of the gospel, when we wander from the way of Jesus, then the transformation that otherwise should be taking place comes to a halt, and we find ourselves being identified with something that often is the opposite of Christ. To wander from the truth is a moral direction that leads a person away from Christ's likeness into a life of worldliness. So he's describing the person, but I want you to realize that the description that we see in the first part of verse 19 is not really for the wanderer, because it is likely that that person is never going to hear this. They've wandered away, so they're probably not in a place, a church service or a Bible study group or a gathering where this message would resonate with them. He's talking about believers because he addresses them as brothers and sisters, as members of the family. And so he's referring to people within the church. Now, does it have application outside that? And does it have application to who's your one and the outreach emphasis that we're making? Certainly it has application there. But that's not the primary point. The primary point in the context in which this is spoken needs to be kept intact so that your understanding doesn't drift away. He's talking about people who have willfully decided to abandon their faith or to walk away from it in a way that is now leading them down a path that is contrary to what they've known before. You say, well, was that person ever a believer to begin with? I don't know that. I wouldn't even begin to suggest that. Well, they sure don't act like it. No, but I don't either all the time. This is where you're either going to move forward with the rest of the sermon and embrace it, or this is the end of it for you. Because you're either going to look at the person who wanders away and you're going to say, well, it's their own fault. They deserve what they get. Or you're going to say, it breaks my heart to see them leaving the faith. You're either going to care with a sense of compassion and a sense of urgency, or you're going to be disinterested and you're going to say, well, it's their own fault. I want you to think of an example where we have this very thing at work, and I learned this by listening to someone else talk about it a few months ago, and I found it intriguing, and so it kind of sparked a little. Sometimes when you're preparing sermons or Bible studies and things like that, you find yourselves on tangents or rabbit holes. Now, you learn things. It's just not relative to whatever it is that you're preparing for or what you're doing. And so you hope and you pray that somewhere along the way that rabbit hole experience has allowed you to gain some knowledge that you'll be able to utilize later. That's what I'm doing now. This is rabbit hole information. It had to do with the prodigal. We all know the story of the prodigal, and the prodigal son was he was a terrible person. He told his father he wanted to leave the home, he wanted his inheritance given to him in advance, and he was going to go do his own thing, and he didn't want anything to do with anybody there. And the father let him do it. Let him go his way. But what does the Bible tell us about it? It tells us that every day he went and he looked out to see if his son would return. And when the day came, when the son finally came back, destitute and broken, filled with nothing more than remorse and guilt over all that he had experienced in his failed efforts at self-sustainment, he begged the father simply to receive him as a servant in the house, and the father refused, lifted him up, put a ring on his finger, and put a new robe on him, and celebrated with a great feast, for his son that was lost was now returned. And then the story diverts, because this is not the only son. There was an elder brother. And the elder brother stands outside the celebration, fuming because of the fuss that is being made over this lost prodigal who doesn't even deserve to be allowed in the house. And the father says to him, why are you upset? Well, I've been here all along. I've worked and I've toiled, and you've been rewarded. All of this belongs to you. Here was what I learned. The reason that the return of the prodigal ignited anger in the older brother was because it made him feel guilty that he had not gone after his brother in the first place. It was the elder brother's responsibility to care enough for his younger sibling to go to him, and he never did. He stayed home, went about his business, and built up this wall of self-righteous judgment that he would later then just pour out on him. That's the Christian way, isn't it? You mess up, well, you deserve it. You become the object of gossip. You become the focus of speculation. People don't have any idea what's going on in your life or what may have motivated your wandering in the first place or why you're there, because no one ever asks. We just talk about it amongst ourselves. All of it in absolute contradiction to what James has been teaching regarding body life up to this point, and yet it is the natural, sinful inclination, but because it takes place in the context of the church, or it takes place under the guise of, well, we're just talking about it so that we'll know better how to pray for this person. All of that is a load of junk. And it is nothing more than some sort of baptized, sanctified effort in self-righteous, older brother mentality that is absolutely, absolutely contrary to Jesus. Now, you say, wow, stepping on toes much, yes. Just keep in mind, mine are out there too. I am both metaphorically and literally an older brother. And I get this in a way that a lot of you don't. And I understand this in a way that strikes at the very core of who we are. But what I'm telling you is, just because you don't like it or I don't like it doesn't mean it isn't still true or that we shouldn't do something about it. So I'm trying to help all of us together to come to a better understanding that what those who've wandered from the truth are doing is hurting them, and that we have to decide, are we going to be compassionate and are we going to reach out? Are we going to try and help? Are we going to be prayerful and concerned? Are we just going to sit back with crossed arms in judgment of those who have walked away? So we need to have care for the wayward. We need to be committed to restoration. Look at the second part of verse 19. If anyone among you, If anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, the emphasis here is on the person bringing them back. In the same way that believers are encouraged to not disassociate from the poor or the sick in the book of James, we also must not abandon the person who's veered down the wrong path. And so there has to be an intentionality about that, whether it's through a small group or whether it's through an individual contact or whether it has to do with someone, family, friend, or otherwise that we know, that we see doing something that we know is going to lead them in the wrong direction. To bring someone back, we must be intentional. We have to reach out to that person with purpose and with a sense of loving restoration. It is not to heap coals on them. It is not to bring judgment on them. It is not to make them feel guilty or are foolish or any of those things. The intention has to be restoration. There has to be a commitment to a compassion that shows forth so that others will know. Sometimes all people need to find their way back is someone to guide them, but also to walk with them. There is a caution against judgmentalism that cannot be overstated. Simply condemning the erring person for their sinfulness ignites shame and guilt, as I mentioned earlier. Shame and guilt lead to hiding and denying. Think about it. I've used the illustration so many times that I couldn't count them, but there is none better. Right after Adam and Eve sinned, God came looking for them. Where were they? They were hiding. They'd made for themselves covering. And as soon as God addressed them and called them out of their hiding, then what started? The blame game. The woman you gave me, she gave me the fruit. The serpent that you created, he tempted me with this. Nobody wants to take responsibility. Nobody wants to own what has happened. Guilt and shame lead to hiding and denying. And it leaves people trapped in an endless cycle of guilt and shame that robs us of everything, leading ultimately either to an implosion of depression or leading to an outburst of anger against all things spiritual. Understanding it doesn't make it easier to contend with, but at least it gives you some indication of what's coming. Judgmentalism is simply not going to work here. To bring back to the truth of the gospel is to restore a person in the same way that we are originally saved by God's grace through mercy and love. So when God called you to himself, Was it because you were such a terrific person, and was that the first thing that you thought about? Or did he call you to himself, giving you along with that calling? Excuse me. Turn this down, please. I think we're good. We're not great, though. That's just dryness. It's not COVID. And so, everybody always, I mean, if you cough or sneeze anymore, it's just like you just yelled bomb or something. I don't know. People get really nervous. To bring someone back to the truth is to restore them in the same way that we were originally saved. So when you were called by God, did you come because you felt worthy and because you felt like God was really getting a bargain having you on his team? Or did you come in humility and brokenness and in the awareness that you were not only a sinner, but your sin separated you from God? And as a sinner, you were destined to eternal separation, what we refer to as hell. I think that if you would be honest, you would realize that you came with an overwhelming sense of awe and wonder at the grace of God in the midst of your abject failure. And what drew you was his love. He didn't love you because you were perfect. He loved you because you weren't. He didn't love you when you got all cleaned up and spick and span. He loved you while you were a broken sinner. In the same way, that teaches us a lesson of restoration and how we reach out to those who are wayward. We do it with love and with grace, not with condemnation. Third, we must be convinced of God's mercy. Convinced of God's mercy. The only thing that will motivate us to do this isn't the brokenness of the person alone, but it has to be combined with the absolute certainty in the grace of God. In verse 20, it says, "Let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." The word "let him know" is a call to remember what follows. One of the most powerful acts of faith may be the ability to believe in God's mercy on behalf of the person who has strayed from the path, so that you, as a member of the body of Christ, seeing the waywardness of a friend or loved one, you know that you can believe that God is able to bring them back, that God is able to do in their life something that they may not be able to do themselves at that moment. Does that mean that every wayward person that you talk to is going to return? It does not mean that. And it doesn't mean that that is the focus of our obedience. Our obedience is based on the word of truth. God says, reach out to the wandering one. He doesn't say what's going to happen when you do. We leave the results to God and we follow the way of obedience. Let him know, though, that this is the will of God. This is the purpose of God. Know that when you do this, you're doing something that is consistent with all that God has called us to. So much like the prodigal, people think they have to be, think that they have become unlovable and the Father is not going to receive them. They're no longer worthy of his grace. The person helping to restore, though, can demonstrate God's mercy by helping others to trust during times of repentance and restoration and helping to guide and support as that process unfolds. Turning a person back to the way of truth is turning them away from the path of death. All sin leads to death. Jesus said, "I have come that you may have life, and have it more abundantly." Now, does this mean that a person that wanders away has lost their salvation and now they're going to die and go to hell? It does not necessarily mean that. That's not what this is addressing. In fact, I would caution you about pushing these verses beyond the general nature of their context. They are not given in order to specify particular points of detail regarding any one or other doctrinal truth. they are given as an overall plea to the church to care about the brothers and sisters in it and their spiritual well-being. He says he will save his soul. It's not talking about the one who reaches out. He's talking about the one who's wandered. He will save his soul. The word soul there is not a reference just to the inner being, but it is a reference to the entirety of the person. And so the soul represents the individual, saving them from death, the physical death that is sure to come as a result of a sinful lifestyle or a worldly focus, but also death as it relates to everything else, so that when we live our lives for the things below, all of those things are going to ultimately decay and pass from the scene. And then he says he will cover a multitude of sins. The point of this is not to enumerate the number of sins of your wayward brother or sister. You say, well, multitude's a lot, so this friend of mine that has wandered from the truth has pretty much committed a lot. I wonder if it'll be enough. The point of this is not for you to focus on the sinfulness of another nor yourself. The point of this is to focus on the grace and mercy of God. What he is doing when he is showing us this, it's not to enumerate the sins of the individuals, it's to elevate God's grace. What he's saying is that the grace of God is sufficient for the multitude of sins that you would commit in all of your life. He's talking about forgiveness in its entirety. Talking about grace. Keep in mind that what we're doing when we're turning someone back to the truth, we're not turning them to their faults or their brokenness or to your piety. We're turning them to God's grace and mercy. The same grace and mercy that redeems is that which also works in us to keep and to sanctify. So that as he brings all of this to a close, he does so in order to help us to understand that discipleship and following the way of truth is one that produces transformation. Doesn't mean it is without its pitfalls. There are difficulties and there are tangents along the way that can lead us in the wrong direction. We have a responsibility for one another, not to be nosy or to be judgmental or gossips and accusers. We have a responsibility as members of the same family to care about the spiritual welfare of one another, and to encourage and to reach out and to do the hard work that takes courage and conviction to reach out to those who've wandered from the truth, in the same way that we need to do the hard work of being disciple makers and reaching out to the lost. So where are you? Did you end up cold, hard, and indifferent, or did you end up soft, pliable, and ready to be obedient? Don't raise your hands. I don't need another list to keep up with. If you're still cold, hard, and indifferent, we need to talk. Maybe the one who's wandered from the truth.